Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
This is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling like an out-of-towner.
What do you mean, Rob? Why?
Well, because I'm now living by the seaside.
Whereabouts? Where is that seaside
town? I don't know, and I'm not going to say because your LA agent doesn't like the word beginning with M. Margate.
Yes.
I've just come back to London to meet our incredible guest this evening.
Thank you for that.
I was walking the streets like I've never seen London before. I'm like completely hyped up. And
that's Rocky shaking in the background.
Rocky's in agreement.
Didn't you bump into like four people as well since you've been in London
for
an hour?
Okay, well basically since I've moved to Margate, I've been like, oh, it's so great. I feel so connected to other people. I walk out of my door, people say good morning
to
me.
You're like a little community.
Yeah, I've got like a community and friends and I'm being so happy. And then I come to London and four people stop me in the street who I know who are like, Rob, oh my gosh, what are you doing here?
Were they that excited?
Yeah, and I'm like, oh, actually, I have a community in London. Oh. So basically,
well, you've got an international community, basically.
We do, and the reason I'm mentioning this whole idea of being out of town is that our guest tonight has currently been in the countryside for a good few months, directing an amazing new TV show called Industry. Mm-hmm. Is it a TV show or a film?
It's a TV show, but you've done your research. I'm so impressed. It's not even out yet.
Love this, and
it's on Deadline and stuff, though.
I guess it's in the world.
Like okay. I read Deadline. I don't even know how I think you told me. Anyway, so then she has been in Wales, and Wales is where my family are from, so I feel
yes,
a super connection to our guest tonight.
Yay!
Welsh connection.
Yes, and I was just in Wales myself, so I've had the healing effect of...
Where were you in Wales?
I was in Aberystwyth.
Oh, yeah. I haven't been to Aberystwyth yet. I have kept my Welsh travels pretty limited, but I'm hoping to use my upcoming vacation week to really see what's what in the Welsh countryside.
Good one. Your vacation week. Okay, hang on. Let's just introduce you.
Everyone guessed my name.
So our guest today is come all the way from America.
Via Wales.
Via Wales. Lena Dunham.
Yay! I'm so honored. I love this podcast, and I'm have always been, since the moment I met Russell Tovey, first met his dog, then met him in my father's art gallery in New York. Russell was there, and I was like, who's that dog? Wait, he belongs to that handsome actor whose work I know and have admired. And now that actor is telling me that he's an art collector with a shocking knowledge of art history. And he's not sexually or emotionally available to me. What is happening?
You got me.
I'm really honored to be with you guys. I love the podcast. And it's so amazing to hear two people who are so engaged with, you know, art as a concept and talking art.
Thank you so much. Well, about that day is that what's incredible for me about that day is that I went to your dad's show, Carol Dunham's show, and I love his work. And you were there at the opening and I was kind of like slightly starstruck to meet you. I think you're equally phenomenal. We can just like...
So sweet.
We can just jerk each other off now. And and then we chatted and we swapped emails. And then as I'm leaving... I was going to go and talk to this other artist who was there who I absolutely love called Joe Bradley. And I couldn't because I couldn't build up the confidence because I'm such a fan. And
that's then, also so cool because you're like one of the only people on the planet who wouldn't have the confidence to talk to Joe Bradley. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like you're like, Tom Cruise was there and I just couldn't say anything. Like, yeah. Joe Bradley's an amazing artist, but I just think it's cool that that was your
position. Oh, no, I get complete. I was at a dinner the other night. I was at a River Cafe and Ed Roche was sat across the way.
That's a big one.
And I went to pieces and I said to the maitre d',
I said,
is that Ed Roche? He's like, yeah. I was like, that's fucking crazy. I said, can you introduce me? He's like, yeah, he's really sweet. And I went over and I was like, Mr. Ruscha. I said, hi. And he went, hey, how are you? I said, I'm
your great. Impressions fucking slay me of like American art people.
And then I said, can I get a selfie with you? And he's like, sure. I was like, oh my God. And then
I was so jealous. I was like texting nice? Him. Like,
lovely. So lovely. But I was really wobbly. Secret.
No one ever asks artists for selfies unless it's like, you know, there's like three artists people ask for selfies. Pause it's or- like... It's like...
Well, like who then, do you think? Who
maybe these? Cindy Sherman, yeah. Salvador Dali, if he wasn't dead.
Andy Warhol. Yeah.
Andy Warhol would also love dead. A selfie. He would love to do a selfie. But I can't think of any other artist who gets recognized and asked for photos. So it's like that kind of celebrity in the art world, it isn't really easy to come by. So I think it's probably like incredibly meaningful when somebody recognizes them and expresses their gratitude who isn't just, you know, a collector or a newspaper.
Yeah, and it was just in a restaurant. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. But anyway, so the Joe Brady thing, I couldn't talk to Joe Brady, and then this lady came up to me and she watched Looking. She said, oh, me and my husband watched Looking. We really love it. I said, that's really interesting. Like a heterosexual couple have been watching Looking and following. I said, that's great. That's like shows the diversity of our audience. And I went, I really want to go and meet that artist, but I haven't got the balls, so I'm going to leave. She went, who, that man there? I said, yeah. She went, that's my husband. I was like,
no.
I was like, what? She went, yeah. And I walked over and he was like, hey. I was like, hi.
No.
And she was like, you remember him in Looking? He was like, sure, yeah, I remember. We watched Looking. And I was just like, this is fucked up. And then I sort of left.
So cool.
And as I left, I got an email and I was trying to get this artwork by this artist called Tori Thornton, who I love. And I've been waiting for ages for this artwork. And as I walked down the stairs, an email came out and said, oh, we've managed to get you this artwork you've been after, pinged up. And I had to go and sit in on a stoop on a doorway and ring my mum and go, mum, this is just like, none of this will make sense to you. You won't know who any of these people are or really care. But for me, this is such an incredible, like, New York moment. Do you know what I mean? That only 100%. Happens in New York.
And it's funny because I've had a few of those since I've gotten to London. I think sometimes when you go to a city, you know, I've had lots of magical nights in New York, but I think sometimes when you go to a city that's not your own and you like the other night I got to go to the Tarantino premiere, like, you know, that's one of those movies where I'm like, okay, I never thought I'd be in a Quentin Tarantino movie. I never thought I'd be living in London when it came out. So I did go to the London premiere. And then I saw Helen McCrory, who's one of my favorite like working actors.
Yeah, she's incredible.
And I wanted to say hi to her and I was scared. And then I walked into the bathroom to pee in the middle of it because it's an amazing movie but very long. And she was in there and she went, oh, hello you. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God. And then I got to call my dad and be like, the lady from Peaky Blinders. So we all have those moments. And I think when you're not in your hometown, you can appreciate it's like it becomes a little bit more of a fantasy and like the Anglophile in me.
Yeah.
Loves it here. I mean, going to the, you know, I've been to the Met Gala 6 times, but going to the Serpentine Gala was way nerdier for me because I'm like, these are all like, you know, like London, you know, people I see on the Daily Mail or people whose novels I read. And like,
do you follow the Daily Mail website?
I'm not proud, but I do read the celebrity gossip on the Daily
hilarious.
Mail. It relaxes me. The only thing I don't like is like, I'll sometimes be reading it and I'll just be like so happy because I'm reading about just like what, you know, Megan Barton Hansen is doing from, she's from Love Island.
Okay.
And then, like, I'll just see, like, them saying some weird sassy thing about me. And I'm like, oh, did you have to ruin my relaxing evening like that?
Oh, no.
But usually, it's blessedly free. Okay, guys, for the viewers at home, listeners at home, that's Rocco snorting. He has a face of an angel.
Rocky, do you have the face of an angel?
More of a gargoyle, but
he's got
so baby, cute. Go and lay down. I'm not going to cuddle you because you make too much noise on the microphone.
He's currently got his feet up on Russell's knee, and he wants to play, clearly.
He doesn't want to play, he just wants to cuddle.
Maybe he wants to cuddle,
but he's so snarfly when he's happy that he like so can't cute. Cuddle because he's a snort bag. He also like might weigh as much as me. Like, how much does he weigh?
He weighs, I don't know, I don't really understand maths and weight. It's 14? Does that make
kilos
sense?
Kilos or pounds? He's definitely not 14 pounds. That's a big man.
Kilos, 14 kilos.
Okay, so we'll have the listeners translate that. But
regardless, he's very cute.
Yes.
I remember when you two met because you sent me a picture and said like, oh my God, I just met Lena Dunham. Sorry, I always call you Lena Dunham and it's
everyone
Lena.
Everyone calls me Lena I'm really and sorry. I'm honored. I love
okay,
it.
Okay, good. I was going to bring that up early on I like, because... I keep
made out with a guy and didn't even correct him. I don't care. Don't care.
Okay, cool. I remember when you met, and at the time, I remember thinking how your show, Girls, probably paved the way in a way for looking to be made.
Roger.
And I really believe that though. And
that would be an honor. That show's so beautiful.
It is so beautiful. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
And I remember just being very excited for you anyway.
Yes.
So, well, it's so exciting to be with you two and get to be a part of this like amazing lineup of people that, I mean, lineup of people you've brought together. And I love that there's, you know, two people. I mean, I know that art is now your career, Rob. Yeah, like, yeah. I love the fact that you have really, like, my dad always says that art collecting, it's not about, like, how much money you have or having the best art advisor or being, you know, making sure you have one of every series, every one of the series. It's about having passion, and the best art collections come from buying things you love. And once I started collecting art, that was really what I followed, was like, it didn't matter to me if it had a pedigree. It didn't matter to me if it was resaleable, as long as I thought it was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I feel like your art collection is so inspiring and emblematic. It's what art collection started out being, which is like specific people's vision come to life through the work they chose to surround themselves by. Mm-hmm. And you still kind of, you kind of are the pinnacle of what I think art collecting should be.
Result. Lovely stuff.
That's really sweet.
What was the first thing you started collecting then? When did you start collecting art?
So the first, you know, I had an art collection. I kind of took for granted that I was kind of born with an art collection.
Yeah.
Because when I was born, not only did I sort of, you know, my parents have done this really lovely thing where my mom has saved one of every photograph she's ever taken for both my younger sibling and me.
No way.
And my dad's done the same with his prints. So wow. I
where,
this,
where are they? Just in storage somewhere?
They're though. In storage. They're at storage facility in New Jersey, a heat and temperature controlled storage facility. And then I also, so I have that amazing gift from my parents that I kind of didn't take the time. And that's why I have a print for Russell that I have to send him. And I've been very derelict about sending him and a drawing.
But this isn't one that's been assigned to you though. This isn't one.
No, it's like one of my, literally, I'm sorry to say it, like, I'm not going to be able to manage all these prints and drawings. So it's an honor for me to offload it to someone.
Offload it onto me, absolutely.
I like to be able to, I just haven't sent it, but to be able to offload it to someone who actually loves it and cares about it.
Yeah.
I've done that only a few times in my life. I gave one to my agent because he's an art collector.
Oh, wow.
Giving one to you. I gave one to a friend when she had a baby, but I don't do it often. But I have this big collection. Then also when I was born, you know, I got a really amazing range of artworks gifted to me since by my parents' friends. So because of that, I have, you know, a Mel Bachner, a Terry Winters, a Lisa Scavage, which something I love so much. I have...
didn't she paint you at some point? Wasn't there like a...
Lisa Scavage would have me in her studio when I was a kid, and I would work on... Sculpey models of her paintings. I don't know what that, and then she would sometimes use that, sit them next to her paintings. We had like a really fun relationship. I always loved her when I was a little kid. I just thought she was the coolest adult.
Cool.
And I still think that, you know, I have an Anna Gaskell, a Gregory Crutzen, a Mallory Marder, Katie Grannon.
What's the Gregory Crutzen of? That's that filmic.
It's a filmic image that is actually in storage, but I love his work beyond measure. So this work, you know, surrounded me, and I didn't really think about the fact that, like, I thought, well, I'm not going to buy art. I have all the art I'm ever going to need. But it wasn't until till I turned 30 that I realized, oh, actually, I have my own perspective. And for me, I really love modern figurative painting by women, and also I've expanded a little to queer people, but I won't kick a gay man or a trans man out of bed for eating crackers. But I really love like to look at figurative paintings by women. So the first thing that I bought as an adult, the first purchase where I was like, oh my god, I can't believe I'm doing this, was a mid-size painting called Striper by Ellen Birkenblit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have
they're kind of like the fox character, isn't it? Or like a wolf or...
This one is a girl who looks like she's kind of vomiting out like a series of pink ribbons. Wow. I love it so much. My ex-boyfriend was like, what is this and why is it in our living room? And then after that, I bought two prints by Ellen, and then a much larger painting of a really big, beautiful high heel shoe. It's like a, I can't even fit it in my current apartment. It's so big. It's at my parents' house. A big, beautiful high heel shoe kind of crushing a cityscape. And then I also just purchased, my dad helped me find the work of Kyle Staver, who's a painter I really love. He introduced me to another painter he introduced me to called Jacqueline Hobby, whose work I'm currently chasing. Mm-hmm. I just bought a beautiful painting by a woman named Jenna Gribben, who shows at Fredericks and Frieser in New York. And then I also collect like a number of more sort of like folk outsider art women. Yeah, nice. So there's a gallery in New Orleans that I love that I started actually buying art from called Red Truck Gallery, where I bought paintings by a woman called Mab Graves and a woman called Penelope Gazin, Kristen Riker, Natalia Fabia. These are like a bunch of sort of really beautiful figurative works I got. And then I became friends with Gabriel Schaffer, who runs Red Truck, which is shows a lot of amazing people. And I sent him sort of shyly just to show him like that I love to paint, never thinking anything of it. A year and a half into when I started painting, I sent him some of just images of my work. And he actually has now ended up including my, he's been incredibly supportive of me painting and has included my paintings in two of his group shows, which is one of the most shocking and unexpected things that
That's so awesome.
I never thought that would happen in my lifetime. My parents were, I can't even say they're proud because they're so confused, but they think it's really funny.
So you've been painting a lot with watercolors, haven't you?
Exclusively watercolors.
Exclusively watercolors.
I love watercolors.
And often you paint female icons of popular culture and also people that mean a lot to you. So I've seen one of your dad, Carol Dunham.
Yep. He's the only man I've really painted.
He's the only man you've painted.
Yep.
But can you talk a bit about why you paint the people that you paint and who you paint?
Well, the thing that I started painting during a really hard period in my life when I felt like I needed a way. Writing wasn't coming easily, and I needed a way to tell stories and think about what was happening in my life and my body and
just
my
to
heart.
Get through a block sort of thing. It was like finding another
exactly
medium
to do that. Knew like I wasn't writing, and if I'm not writing, then I'm not directing, and if I'm not directing, then I'm not making pictures. And so a friend of mine gave me a notepad and some colored pencils, and I was reminded of how much I loved drawing women and portraits of women when I was a kid. And then once it started, and then I, Paul Monroe, who's an amazing artist who actually lives with me in Los Angeles, and he runs a foundation called the Greer Langton Archives Museum, which is to support the work of his wife who passed away in 1996, Greer Langton. He keeps an amazing, amazing sculptor and painter who was one of the first trans women artists to really openly trans female artists to be publicly exhibited. And she has work in, you know, the Whitney, the Met, MoMA. I mean, her work is unbelievable.
Was she photographed by Peter Hujar?
Yes. She was a big Peter Hujar subject.
Got it.
She's a big Peter Hujar subject, big David Wonorowicz subject, and really an iconic figure in 80s and 90s East Village. And Paul owned a store called Einstein's in New York in the 80s and 90s, where he really kind of was, it was like a focal point for a lot of amazing artists, many of whom have since, who we lost during the AIDS crisis, the first gasp of the AIDS crisis. So Paul and I are really close, and he lives with me in LA. And he said, like, in his funny voice, he's like, why don't you try watercolors? And I'm trying to do an impression as good as yours. And he got me some, and I just couldn't believe how good it felt. And I became obsessed with watching, like, I just wanted to know technique. So turns out you can learn a lot from YouTube. Mm-hmm. So I started watching, like, you know, every video I could watch on, like, color mixing and values and, you know, which brush to use with which. And, like, you know, just you just teach yourself technique so you can play around with it and mess around with it. And so I became obsessed with having my close female friends send me selfies of themselves, preferably nude, though I never put pressure on anyone. And I began painting those and sort of started doing it in a larger and larger format. And now I've been working on some paintings that are, you know, about 4 feet tall, but that took a little bit of time to get to.
You work on watercolor paper?
I work on watercolor paper, thick, rough, cold press watercolor paper. I'm very particular about the paper. I've gotten very snobby about my brushes. I've gotten very snobby about my paints. I order them from Japan. I'm obsessed. I find watercolor brushes now in every bag, in every corner. They're everywhere. Every one of my nightgowns is covered in paint. You can see there's paint on the edge of my nightgown
right
now.
I'm like that with dog poop bags. Every pair of jeans or shorts or bag I pull out, got there. We got
this
a dog
is
poop
my
bag.
Dog poop bags. Right. And it's just like, it's become such an obsession that I will be at my actual job, which is creative and amazing, writing, directing, and I'm like, in my head, like, I want to get back to that painting. I need to get back to that painting. Wow.
And you've been doing that in Wales, haven't you? You've been painting plein air.
Yes.
I saw a great picture of you painting.
And I set out, I made a little studio there, set it up.
Let's just explain what plein air is then, Rob.
Plein air is where you paint in nature. So you can sit outside in the fresh air.
I have a beautiful yard in Wales, like the most beautiful yard I've ever seen. I can't even believe it's not just in a magazine. And I go out there in my nightgown with my, you know, canvas. And then I thought, I don't care about painting nature. And then I looked around and I was like, oh my God, nature is the most unbelievable thing. So I don't just paint nature. I've been doing a series of images from lesbian porn with like natural elements around them. So trying to like kind of superimpose
a lesbian in the Welsh countryside.
A lesbian in the Welsh countryside, which they
love
exist.
This.
Oh yeah.
But not ones with breast implants and no pubic hair. So that's what I've been painting.
Gosh. Wow.
Well, that's all anyone's ever wanted to see, really.
And so I have a couple going to this show at Red Truck in August. And then some are going to go to the Miami Basel Red Truck booth. And then when I sell them, I give all the money to this organization called Friendly House I work with, which is a sober living facility and rehab that doesn't turn any women away for cost reasons. So it's like an independent... cost-effective, affordable rehab that I work with. So it's been amazing. And it's given me also a greater passion for collecting because I understand more about not just technique, but sort of what it just gives you. Making things gives you a feel. Like I start to love movies more when I start to make them. I love paintings more. And yeah. I always think it's a little embarrassing when someone tries to step outside their medium and like announce. I'm not going to like announce like I'm making a
artist.
Folk album.
Yeah.
I'm a visual artist.
Yeah.
I know I'm not a visual artist, but as my dad said, the best thing he said, I think it's a very credible hobby you have, which is all I needed from my WASPy dad.
But do you know what? I also think, why limit ourselves? It really frustrates me that, I mean, of course, if you have something you're successful in and you're good at, then that obviously often takes up a lot of your time. But, you know, I think you shouldn't stop yourself. And I thought it was brilliant that you were doing them. And actually, I really
like them
as well. There's quite a few of them I've seen that I haven't seen loads of them, but I've probably seen about five or six of them. And, you know, out of those five or six, I liked five of them. Do you know what I mean?
Like, I think there's a Karen Kalimnik vibe to...
Yeah,
Nicest thing you've ever said to me. Karen Kalimnik.
No, but there's lots of people
favorites.
That I used to collect, like Mari Eastman. I don't know if you know Mari Eastman, but she did loads of watercolor or, you know, watery paintings anyway, on walls.
Amazing.
And a bit Karen Kalimnik
in there.
Totally.
Tracy Emin did some really good watercolors.
Tracy Emin regularly does good watercolors.
Rob has a watercolor of Tracy.
Yeah, I have one above my bed. Yeah,
I actually have a bit of a fantasy about buying a Tracy Emin watercolor because I also want to start collecting more watercolor because I'm obsessed with the medium and watercolor. And it's so crazy what you can do with it and what I can't do with it because I am like, literally the other day I was watching my friend and colleague Liz walked in on me watching a YouTube video, how to paint leopard spots. And I was like, this is humiliating.
But do you think maybe you have been a visual artist, but because of both your parents being artists, there was a reluctance within you to follow that route?
100%. For a few reasons. I think one, it's like if you have two parents who excel at what they do, you want to differentiate yourself. And I was always really conscious of wanting to be my own person who did my own thing and then happened to find this career really early before I had sort of really debated exactly how I wanted to go about my life. Mm. And then the other thing is that I think as a kid, being so immersed in the art world, I saw all the ways in which it was limiting, misogynistic, excluded women and people of color and queer people. Like, they've found their way into the narrative, but by pushing and fighting. And also just the way that, like, I always kind of regarded the art world as a kid. I mean, it was everyone I knew, so I loved it and it was cozy to me, but I could also see the ways in which it was sort of like snobby and tough, and artists were sort of like beholden to incredibly wealthy people to determine their future, and that art collecting isn't. And like, I'm not a person who's like, all right, like, I am never going to be the person who's like, the art world's bullshit and it's an ivory tower. Like, I love it and it's fascinating to me, and it always will be. And it's how my life, I mean, it's why I exist. It's why my parents met. It's why I had the education and the opportunities that I had. But I also think I saw the limits of it. Like, I remember once as a kid trying to going with my dad, like, to Central Park, and there were some drawings and I loved them. And this like man was drawing in Central Park and selling his drawings. And I was like, why do his drawings cost $5? And my dad was like, I don't know. They are like, I think my dad, he didn't say something unkind, but he's like, they're different than what your mom and I do. And I was like, so he couldn't be in a gallery? And he's like, well, probably not. That's not the same kind of art that gets sold in a gallery. And I remember, like, it made me so mad. Like, I don't know what, I was like, but those are great too. Like, why does one person have to, it was that little kid thing of like, that's not fair. I was like, why does he have to sell his drawings in Central Park and someone else has to sell them in a gallery? Like, I was very conscious of what felt like it was, didn't have a lot of equilibrium. And it's not like Hollywood is any better. It's just a bigger version of the same issue. But I think that's one of the reasons I really bridled against the art world. And so did my younger sibling. And my younger sibling, Cyrus, who's a writer as well, also keeps finding themselves kind of pulled back into the art world. So it's a very hard thing to shake off for good.
So did your, just talking about like the misogyny or the difficulty and opportunity, but did your parents ever have that, them conversations, your mum's experience of being in the art world and your dad's experience being in the art world?
Yeah, well, I think something I really respect about my mother, besides everything, is like, she's a pioneer. Like, whether people like her work or they don't, they can't deny that she like pushed and fought and showed up and has been doing it for 40. I mean, she has a 40-year long art career.
Laurie Simmons. I was about to say, for people listening who don't know, Laurie Simmons.
Her name's Laurie Simmons. She's so brilliant and gifted and tough, and she never gave up, and she didn't let all of the endless no's, because she worked with photography and she worked a lot with toys and dolls and miniatures. So she got a lot of people dismissing it as sort of like craft art or women's art or cute art. And she was like, no, this is modern
tough,
art.
And this is tough work. It's like, yeah, because it's got like dolls involved. Do people think it's kind of chintzy or kind of like easy?
But it's not. Taking it's tough. On really tough issues. And she was like, no, this deserves the same pride of place that any man who's making modernist sculptures, you know. And my mom had to really fight, as did, you know, all her friends, Cindy Sherman, Sarah Charlesworth, Louise Lawler, Marilyn Minter. Those are all of her best.
And these were all around you as
friends.
A kid.
Yeah. I mean, those were the women I knew. And those were the women. That's another thing I feel so lucky about, is those are the women I knew who had big careers. Like, that was the women I looked up to. And what I love about my dad, besides everything, is that he, when my mom would say, you know, hey, I got into this situation, it was really tough, I felt, you know, undermined or undervalued, my dad would never go like, come on, buck up, or like, no, it's not that unfair, just keep doing your work. Like, he really heard her and defended her and tried to learn from it. And like, as a result, was able to be a really great ally to me, who's a woman, and my sibling, who's a gender nonconforming person, and support us as we embarked on our own careers with our own challenges around gender. So like, I really got the best
role models
in both of them. Like, a man who could learn and listen, a woman who didn't take no for an answer. But yeah, there were definitely those conversations. And you know, you see, like, when you have parents who are in the art world, like, an art career is very rarely, if ever, a straight line up. Like, so much of it is about trends, and there might just be a year that like photography is not hot, or like 5 years where it's not selling well, or 6 years where people aren't into abstraction, and then they're not into figurative work. And like, and then like, I remember when John Kern and Lucia Scavenge started, everyone was like, what are these people doing using oil paint and doing this like, you know, almost like Renaissance looking work. And now it's like, goes for millions of dollars at auction. So everybody in the art world has to deal, like we do in Hollywood, which you know so well, with that feeling of like, oh, I had this really hot year and everyone was obsessed with me and they couldn't get enough of me and I had to turn things down and wow. And then 6 months where you're like, it's like being a kid at camp and you're like, where did everybody go? Yeah. Like, and that is something I think I was, something I also feel lucky for is I was prepared going into a creative career for the fact that it wasn't just going to be like up, up and away.
Plain sailing, yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And something that I really love that I wasn't actually aware of until recently was that your mum actually made a work of you in 2017. Is that right?
She
for
did.
A series. And obviously her early work, I don't know if the listeners know this or not, but the ones who don't know, often had dolls and small furniture and, you know, they weren't real people.
Yeah.
Whereas the 2000, I think it was 2015 was the first time she started to actually use real life
Wasn't
models.
Meryl Streep in one? No, who was the actress?
Meryl Streep was in a film my mom did.
Yes.
She was in a film my mom did that where she basically played my mom among a bunch of dummies of my dad, which was cool and surreal. But yeah, my mom's, I've been in two photos of my mom's ever besides home photos. I was in one when I was 8 with my best friend, Isabel. It was a dummy. It was when Photoshop first started. I have it in my phone right here, actually, because I just sent it to my best friend because she's coming to visit me.
Who's in the picture with you?
She's in the picture with me, and she's coming to Wales to see me. So here we have a photograph of us where it was just at the beginning of Photoshop. My mom wanted it to be a dummy, and he's in a field dreaming of having a menage a trois with two women, but she needed girls to be the right size for the dummy. So that's Isabel and me.
No way.
In a menage a trois with the dummy.
That's amazing.
She did not say menage a trois. She said you should both be hugging him because she knew not to say.
And now looking back,
you're engaged in three-way sex with a dummy, but that is what was going on. That is 100% what was going on.
And then more recently, the work that she made in 2017, you were actually covered in body paint and you were totally nude, but you wouldn't
totally
immediately recognize that.
Well, here's an interesting thing. I actually had to beg for that one because my mother was going to do, which obviously when I told this story in like New York Magazine, everyone was like, Lena's trying to practice trans erasure. I think you'll agree that was not the story. My mother was doing a photo of my younger sibling, Cyrus, in body paint with binding over their breasts in body paint as Rudolph Valentino. It was like a play on gender and Cyrus's transition. And when I saw the paint, the body paint photo, I was really jealous. And I said, and also there was one of our family dog, not in body paint, but with some like cool elements. And I was like, I'm jealous. I want to be part of this. Like, so my mom was like, well, it's about the fact that Cyrus has gone through so many changes this year. And I was like, I've gone through a lot of changes. I had a hysterectomy and ended my long-term relationship and had some really hard career stuff. And like, that's real too. So I was not trying to practice trans erasure. I just wanted to join the family fun. So my mom said, what do you want me to body paint you as? She said, you're going to have to think of something really good because I'm not just going to do it to be nice to you. And I said, Audrey Hepburn struggled a lot with her physical health throughout her life, with body image, with anorexia, with illness. So I want you to have me body painted as this picture of Audrey Hepburn talking on the telephone in a chair.
Amazing.
And she saw it and was like, that's actually a pretty good idea. So she had to concede. So I got to be in it too. And it was really exciting because then my mom had a big show, a big retrospective at the
Salon 94, was it? Or not?
Salon 94 had the first show, and then the retrospective went to the modern, the Chicago
MoCA. Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. MCA Chicago. Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago.
Yeah.
MoCA. And so they made for the gift shop large cashmere scarves of the pictures of my brother and me.
No way.
Yes, wow. It was really cool.
That's really cool.
I have a large cashmere scarf of myself that I'm not going to wear because the accusations of narcissism will come even faster and more furiously, but I do love
it. They gifted it to you, right? You didn't have to buy that.
They gifted it to me, but I did buy a bunch of t-shirts with pictures of my mom. They did this t-shirt that's like a picture of my mom from the 80s. taking a photograph of herself in a mirror. And it's the coolest. It's like cool like 80s woman. It's a selfie. It's a proto selfie on a white t-shirt. And whenever I wear it, like everyone, without even knowing it's my mom, is like, where'd you get that shirt? It's the coolest shirt I've ever seen. Because it's just a woman taking a 70s selfie. It's beautiful. Wow.
I
have a line in my book where I say my mother, I start a chapter by saying my mother invented the selfie. Mm. I like to say that because she took a lot of photos of herself with her camera on a timer or in the mirror in the 70s, that really, it wasn't just that she was taking them of herself. They looked, the attitude and look of them was much like the selfies we've come to know and love today.
Yeah,
so I like to think my mother was the inventor of the selfie.
I like to think that as well now.
I do too. I love the photo of you from 2017 because of the directness of the eye contact as well. Like you're directly looking in it. And also you look so comfortable. And there's something about, I can imagine, I mean, I don't know if it's true or not, but the fact you know your mum so well and that she obviously knows you so well, but you can really feel that energy in the photograph. And I think it's a very unusual picture of you.
Well,
like it's so kind of raw and honest and touching.
It was interesting because she did not just let me sit there. She was really bossy. She was like really knew what she wanted.
Have you seen her at work before though? Have you?
Yeah. I mean, my whole childhood, I was in her studio with her.
Is the studio in your house?
And the studio was in our house and is now in our house in the country.
And your dad's studio is in...
Mm-hmm. So I grew up...
But also that became part of Tiny Furniture. So the first film you ever made was called Tiny Furniture, but it had your mum as an artist in the house and your character comes home and...
But you know, mostly my mom took pictures of inanimate objects that looked animate, so she didn't have to be very bossy. And when she takes pictures of people who aren't me, I can hear her directing them, and she's really loving, and she gets what she wants. But then with me, she was like, close your mouth. Don't try to make that fish face. She's like, you're making a face like all those girls making like pictures in
Daily Mail.
Like, why are you doing that? No, mouth open, this, look at me, sit up straight. And it kind of disarmed me, but she really knew what she wanted. She didn't let me get away with anything, so I could. And then it took actually 3 hours and three people to get the full black body paint off of my. But I was so shocked, and I was finding like streaks of black. Like, I mean, literally, you will all enjoy this. I got a text from my mom the night before the photo shoot where she was like, 6 a.m., don't be late, bring a bathrobe, shave everything, and I mean everything. So I don't know how many of you have gotten texts from your mom telling you to shave your pubes.
You didn't shave your head, though.
Nope, left that, but it had to be a full legs, arms.
Your mom telling you to shave your pubes. I love your feet as well, because you had like ballet shoes painted on, though.
Painted, and that was my mom's vision. The person was like, it's going to look weird with the toes. My mom was like, just trust me. But they also had to paint my toenails black to go with it. It was a really amazing process. She hired this woman who runs a company called Body of Art. And she is like, does all the Sports Illustrated, or she learned from the woman who does all the Sports Illustrated, like body paint swimsuits. But of course, we were not getting sexy body paint. We were getting serious art body paint.
Where is this paint photograph now? Do you know?
Well, there's a bunch of them. We must have an edition of it. There, a bunch of them sold. I was so shocked of that people wanted it in there, wanted me staring at them with my nipple peeking out of my shirt
about
in their
that,
house.
That work, though, is that it's actually a really great work. And it's
sort
so
of
nice.
It doesn't feel like it's about me.
You,
like, it's
exactly.
Not Lena Dunham, the controversial writer, director. It's just like a woman, and it really takes its own form. And I was very moved looking at it because I didn't recognize myself.
Yourself, exactly, yeah.
And I think that was my mom's goal, and she transformed everyone that she touched with that, I think. And people, I'm really proud of her because of the way she just, so easy for artists to sort of rest on their laurels and keep remaking the things that they've made in new ways. And my mom just like, she's always pushed herself really hard, and it's a quality I really, and the thing I learned from her is like, part of the reason I felt comfortable painting was because my mom, you know, made her first movie at 55 and then made her first feature at 68 and has, you know, collaborated with fashion designers. She's designed a dollhouse. She's done work to hang in restaurants.
Oh, yeah.
She's done
that
fashion
neon dollhouse. It slaps into each other, doesn't
it? It's amazing.
Yeah.
It was called the Kaleidoscope House.
Oh,
it was sold for years and years at the MoMA,
it's
at
like
the
an
MoMA design store. She and her friend Peter Wheelwright designed this modernist dollhouse that was just stunning. And unusual. And I got to be a doll in it. That was really cool.
Right.
She did dolls of my sibling and me. It was funny because she and Peter, who's my dad's best friend, designed the dollhouse together. So my mom did a doll of her and a doll of Peter as the married couple, and then all their children as the children. And so my dad and Peter's spouse were kind of like, so you guys just erased us and made yourself married as dolls? What's going on here?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the Southbank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also given people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
So with two artist parents... You're technically an artwork, by the way, because you're created by...
You're not the first. My mom has definitely once, you know, like weaker moment, been like, you two are the greatest artwork we've ever created. And my sibling was like, please don't refer to us as artworks, but I don't mind. I like it.
I think it's hilarious. But growing up in New York, you were born mid-80s, weren't you?
1986.
Yeah. So do you have memories of that whole kind of period of the AIDS epidemic and an artist then? I remember Russell saying to me that you once told him a story that really was touching.
Yeah, an incredible story you told me.
Yeah, I mean, I think I told you about my Uncle Jimmy, my mom's best friend, who was an incredible artist, who actually my mom still runs his estate and is working with the Fales Library at NYU to keep it alive and Salon 94. His name was Jimmy DeSanta. He was an incredible photographer.
He was a queer artist.
Artist who my mom met on the... She met him on the subway going out to Coney Island. She saw a beautiful man wearing all white with a camera around his neck that he had spray painted white and a white straw hat and white slippers and a diamond choker. And she was like, you know, she was from Long Island, from like a Jewish community in Long Island. She'd never seen anybody who looked like that. And she was just getting into photography and they became best friends. They lived together. He taught her everything she knew about being a photographer and they had a dark room in their home. And then once my father and mother got together, Jimmy moved to a loft in the same building, but in the around the back.
Where was that area?
On Broadway between Prince and Spring and Soho.
Oh, great. Wow, wow.
And the apartment that I lived in until I was 13 is the one that my mom got with Jimmy. And in the year that I was born, he was diagnosed with AIDS. And, you know, as we know, there was nothing to do then. So it wasn't like, you know, you're diagnosed with HIV and you take care of yourself. It was like he was diagnosed with full-blown AIDS and within... You know, he was diagnosed the year I was born, and he died when I was 4. And he was, you know, my mom, she was with him when he passed, and he was her best friend. And, you know, it's something that's actually at hard moments with my mom I've had to remind myself of and really have empathy for is that I don't know what it's like to lose a huge slice of your community. And even though my mom... isn't a queer man, those are the people like me. I mean, my best friends are gay men. That's my I like to say that's my target demo. But she lost so many people she loved. She lost, you know, her other best friend was an artist called Robert Kitchen who died 10 years ago, and his twin brother passed from AIDS. Her community was just going down, and she was so many women in the art world. Because so many men were living away from families that didn't accept them, often their female best friends became their mothers, their caretakers. And Jimmy actually had an amazing mother who my mom was really close with. And she still cooks a dish called chocolate derby pie that Jimmy's mother taught her to make and is in touch with his family and his former partner and is really what's been one of the most moving things is my mom doesn't cry about it and she doesn't. She's not a particularly kind of nostalgic person. She's kind of anti-nostalgic, even though her work is nostalgic. But she has worked harder than she's worked for herself to make sure that his work got its moment in the sun. And like she single-handedly got Salon 94 to start showing him. She got Fales Library to take on his estate. She found interns and countless hours cataloging it and sold the work and... You know, that's her way of keeping him alive with her.
Wow.
So incredible.
You told me an amazing story about that time that as a kid living in New York at that time, you would recognize if someone had AIDS and you would just know to yourself like, oh, that person's got AIDS and you'd see them walking around and you just knew.
Well, you knew because I knew my mom told me because Jimmy would come over all the time.
And would he look ill?
He was very thin. He had, you know, I don't think he actually did have Kaposi sarcoma, but he was very thin, very unwell looking. He was handsome, but by the time I can remember him, he was not the person he had been. He'd been very fit, like very focused on his body, and he was completely wasted away. And so my mom said to me when I was a kid, because she had to, she said, Jimmy's sick. So if anything ever happens and Jimmy falls over or he's bleeding, you can't touch him. You can't touch it. And, you know, I think that was how she knew to explain, like, you know, they didn't know really. They knew HIV was spread from sex and from blood. And now we know that, like, you know, someone touching someone's blood on the ground is probably not going to be a transmission. But so she explained to me, Jimmy's sick. This is what he's sick with. This is what you do if something happens to him or he falls down or he's bleeding. And so then I would see other men on this. I remember seeing them on the subway. I remember seeing one in the bank who looked like him, had the same drawn look, hat, big coat, and you just knew, you go, oh. And at, by a certain age, if I was 10 or something, I could say, does that man have AIDS? My mom would say, yes, he does. Or, you know, and the answer is usually, yes, he does. So that's a time. It's really hard for me to explain, especially to young people, because now when I meet young people, if I meet a 22-year-old, they have no memory of that.
No.
They don't even remember a time when they were really told that HIV was a real threat to them because of the way that young people are engaging in sex now. So it's like really wild to explain, okay, in the 80s, Soho was a wasteland. There were no stores. There was nothing. HIV and AIDS were a death sentence, and it was everywhere. And I mean, Paul had something, Paul, my roommate in Los Angeles, had something like 80 people at his wedding, and within 3 years, 60 of them had died. That's not a amount that we can, I have to try to explain to people when they, think like when someone once said like, Paul can be kind of tough. And I was like, you have to understand, like, Paul lost as many friends as if you had lived through a genocide.
Yeah.
It's a literal comparable number. Like, you only hear other numbers like that if someone's describing having lived in pre-war Germany or Rwanda, you know? So it's something I try to also be really cognizant of when I deal with gay men of that generation, is also showing them the proper respect that honors their trauma. Like, a gay man over 50 can be as mean as he wants to me. I don't even care. Like, I'm just taking it on the chin.
You know, it's quite interesting because I spent time with Maripol, who was Madonna's stylist when Madonna first became a big pop star, and all that look that Madonna, we know, was, a lot of that was styled by Maripol. And I interviewed her a number of times in New York and spent a few weeks with her many, many years ago, like 12 years ago or something. And she said to me that it was literally like where her studio was, which she still lived in at the time I was interviewing her in New York. She said the whole block, you know, and then the next block and the next block and the next block were just silent. And all the people that she used to walk down the street and everyone would shout out the windows at her and they'd say hi and all that stuff. It was just silent and everyone had died. And she said they were all her friends because she was hanging out with Keith Haring and, you know, that whole generation of artists and club kids, and they all died. Yeah. And it was only that moment. I was probably like 27 when I was hanging out with her. And I remember just being so shocked by the reality of that. When I walked home to my hotel, you know, from her apartment and was walking down those blocks, they were all bustling, you know, in, you know, 2007 New York. And I just suddenly thought, if this was just dead now, like empty, you know, the impact that must have on you walking through those streets, it's just so full on. And Russell and I went to see Inheritance, the play. And I think in a way, through art now and plays and film, is how we continue that message
Angels
as well.
Angels in America.
Angels in America as well, that Russell was in. I mean, all of these kind of plays, and also your mum doing all that work to help that, you know, artwork stay alive, is what's important. You know, we need to keep remembering those kind
Absolutely.
Of things.
Wow. Absolutely.
Thank you for sharing that story.
Oh, it's an honor. And, you know, getting to talk to Russell about it was really moving. And also because so much of the work that he's done has been about what I think is amazing about Looking, and what's amazing about the way that you've participated actively as a queer man in Hollywood, is that you're saying, no, actually, I am not going to shy away from playing gay characters. I want to play the gay characters because there's a whole culture that we actually do need to preserve. And yes, everybody should be having, you know, equal opportunity and mingling with each other and, you know, playing all kinds of characters who aren't themselves. But like, there is an important legacy to preserve and a continuing, and that legacy lives on in current queer culture, and it's got to be upheld.
Definitely.
I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm really passionate about collecting art by women and queer people, is because I still want to look at art by people who aren't at the center of the conversation about art, but make it anyway. Like, that's just always what's going to be interesting to me.
In the margins, sort of, I guess, sort of, yeah.
Absolutely.
Wow. So, on a lighter note, who was the exciting artist that you had round your parents' house? That probably at the time, did you ever take it for granted that you were surrounded by these monoliths of the art world?
I definitely took it for granted. I was definitely like, these people are old and boring. I loved when Lisa Yaskavich would come over because I loved her work and I knew, I thought it was like cool.
Yeah.
Meeting John Waters in fourth grade was a very big
deal
for me.
Did he come to your house?
he didn't come to my house, although I'm going to brag, we now live in the same building in New York, and he does not care at all. My mom had a retrospective in a mid-career retrospective at the Museum of Baltimore, Baltimore Museum, and he came to the opening. And I remember
that's where he's from, right?
That's where he's from. Yep. And he came to the opening. He offered to take my dad on a tour of gay bars. And my dad was like, yes. And my mom was like, you have to go home and put our children to bed. and he said to me, which I really enjoyed, I was like, I'm obsessed with you. And my mom was like, she had a Hairspray themed 10th birthday party, which I did. Hairspray, not the musical, like the original movie with Tracy Turnblad and with, you know, Ricky Lake all the way. And he said, a 10th birthday party. You must be a fucked up little 10-year-old. And I thought it was
the best.
I was like, I was talking about it for like months. And all my friends at school were like, who's John Waters? We don't care. Just like they didn't care about my birthday party. So that was a big one. I remember seeing Kim Gordon from Sonic Youth out at openings. Like, and I was like, you know, a teenager who was like, thought I was a real punk. And I was like, just beside myself. And that's always interesting. The people who cross over into the art world, like Steve Martin is a big art collector.
Yeah. I actually met Steve Martin. I get into that. But wasn't Kim Gordon an artist and Sonic Youth was kind of like an art project and then it just took off?
100%. She still considers herself a visual artist.
I mean,
she's an amazing visual artist.
I hung out with her recently in LA and she's the best. The coolest.
The coolest.
We went to that crazy party with Emma Reeves. It was amazing because Emma's really good friends with her.
She's so cool and hot.
I just loved her though. She had the coolest energy. She's like so open.
She had a clothing line that I used to wear. It still exists in Japan, but when she ran it, it was called X Girl, and they had a store on Lafayette Street, and it was like this really cool, like kind of like rock skate minimalist clothing, and it was expensive, but my mom would like if they had a big sale, I had like an X-Girl mini skirt and an X-Girl t-shirt that said "We X-Girl," and I wore it, and like, again, it did not help to get me any friends at school.
We as in the French "we," or right,
"we" as in the French "we," with like a cool picture of Kim Gordon's face, X-Girl. And I was like, I remember seeing Kim Gordon out at a gallery and just being like, this is the coolest moment of my whole life. I was like, oh my god. I was also obsessed with Leonardo DiCaprio, like everyone. But when Titanic came out, it was like Gregory Crutzen took me to see Titanic with his then girlfriend Anna Gaskell. I was 10. I wept hysterically in the theater. And Leonardo DiCaprio at that point had just started collecting art and was like around in galleries. So my dad had met him. And then like his art dealer had met him and Gregory and Anna had met him. And I would just like go to every opening I went to, anyone I talked to, I'd be like, have you seen Leonardo DiCaprio? Has he been here? What was he wearing? Like, I just couldn't stop. I know he had carved the name Leo into the roof of Greg, like the ceiling of Gregory's car with a key. Really dickish thing to do. But I mean, he was 20 or something. Mm-hmm. And I think he was being, and probably was considered adorable. And I remember like, now, just so you guys know, I have no romantic feelings for Leonardo DiCaprio. I respect him as an artist, but he's not my type. But back in the day, aggressive passion. And I remember like sitting in Gregory's car, literally running my fingers over the letter, fingering Leo. The Leo.
That is amazing.
Well, so, you've met Leonardo DiCaprio in Venice.
Yes, I went to Venice, but also in New York. The Venice story I've already told in the show.
Yeah. Well, I'm in a movie with him and I can't even meet him.
Oh, yeah,
so
you're in the new Tarantino movie with him.
I am, and I
and
saw
Brad
him at the
Pitt.
I did meet Brad Pitt.
Do you like Brad Pitt?
He's the nicest person alive, and he loves
art. Would you finger
his
name? He loves art. I'd love
him
to come on the show.
Brad's more of a platonic relationship, right. So I would high five his name.
Yeah.
But he's amazing, and everyone else should finger his name. But he loves art and takes art very seriously, and you know, has talked about this publicly. His interest in making art, his interest in collecting art. He's incredibly interested, supportive. He let me make a little drawing of him. He's one of the only other men I've painted. I drew him on the set. I drew hit all
did
my
you give
co-stars.
It to him?
You know, he did. I didn't give it to him, but I made him a painting. I made a painting of my best friend Jemima. That's sort of an abstracted painting that I'm going to give him, just because, not that he wants to put it up, but he's been so lovely to me, and that was, you know, a nerve-wracking set to go on, and he took such good care of me that I just wanted to like say a thank you.
Wow.
But I saw Leonardo DiCaprio last night and was like, hello, nope, okay, bye. He's totally nice. I just was scared. I was scared.
Mm-hmm.
I still get scared.
So Steve Martin, what was your Steve Martin story?
I just remember seeing him in a gallery and like freaking out because he was just around. He collected art. He was like in Metro Pictures. But I loved him. I loved Parenthood. I loved,
I was
going
to say,
like,
when we were kids as well, he was everywhere.
He was everywhere.
That must have been really surreal to see.
He was incredible. Yeah. Anytime I saw, like, seeing an actor to me was the, like, height. And it's funny because now seeing an actor, it's like you could throw a rock and hit an actor. No offense, Russell. You're one of my favorites.
You can throw a rock at me. It's fine.
But then it was really, like,
yeah, but the, he's like, that was when Hollywood was like Hollywood, like Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Bruce Willis, Julia Roberts. It was like that. That's when they were like, they weren't on Instagram or Twitter.
Untouchable.
You had no idea about anything.
It's crazy.
They were
like,
doing.
It's like funny. I don't get, like, Demi Moore's a really close friend of mine and an amazing supportive woman. And her new book is so good, Inside Out. And everybody has to read it because it is. It doesn't just apply to mega movie stars. It will apply to everyone's trauma and pain. And it's beautifully written. But it's funny, like, when I see Demi, she really, even though we're really close, sometimes I'll just be looking at her from a distance and be like, God, that woman is famous and beautiful and talented, because she evokes a time when Hollywood still, it's like she's the last of the glamour. Like, now, of course, we have, like, you know, Tilda Swinton and Kate Blanchett and, you know, Lupita Nyong'o and these people who are these beautiful, epic stars.
Yeah.
But it's different. It's just a different thing.
Because on Instagram. Because you know about their lives. Before, you had no idea about their lives, only what you were told by the bits that leaked out in the press.
Yeah.
But there wasn't gossip. It wasn't
no,
like...
No, it's a different thing.
Yeah.
No
it was
one
like
was
they
being
were, they
like...
Were, they were completely held up there.
No one was
like,
being like, thank you to my sponsors, Evian. Like, yes. It was a total... which I did like 2 weeks ago because they let me go to Wimbledon and take my dad.
Oh, that's good. That's
that
a
was
good. Thank
that
you.
Was like the nice thank you I could do to my dad for being nice to
I've
me.
Just seen your finger. You've got Tip, which is your dad's... pet name, right?
Yes, his nickname.
I have Tip and Laurie. So my dad's nickname is Tip. So that's on my.
What does that mean? Why is he called Tip? Because that's what, when I started speaking to him, people were like, oh, you've just met Tip. And I was like,
you're like, who? I know. And it's like, so, it's actually very English to have a weird little name like that. Mm. But there's debate, but he's from a waspy family and wasps love to give each other nicknames. Like, they just love it. And he was really.
And the wasp for our British audience is
white Anglo-Saxon Protestant American. So you guys have tons of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants here, but we have them too. But it's like this old, it connotes a kind of old, kind of New England. It's not necessarily wealth, but it's a certain kind of like white, kind of often male, but they are women wasps too, cultural privilege. And it is a certain personality type, like a kind of. Steely, flinty, not overly emotional. And my dad breaks many of those stereotypes, but by being named Carol Dunham, aka Tip, he does not. And as a kid, there's some debate about whether he was walking or sitting in the bathtub, but he couldn't stand up straight. So his cousin started calling him Tipper, and then it was shortened to Tip.
Oh, I see.
And he used to really get mad when he was publicly called Tip in any way. Like, he didn't like acknowledgement of it because he was like, that is my nickname. I do not want to talk about it. But like, at a certain point with like social media and email and whatever, like you can't fight town hall. Like, people know his name is Tip.
Yeah, yeah. When did you get the tattoos?
I got these tattoos, actually the finger ones, about, I had just come out of the hospital and I've had a lot of health issues and my parents have really been there for me. And about 4 months ago, I had gotten out of the hospital and they had been such angels that I just was like, I'm going for it. So I have Tip and Laurie, and then I have Cy, which is my brother's nickname.
Oh,
my sibling's nickname. When they became Cyrus, which is their name, that I got that on my chest. So I try to keep the.
And have, they, your, have your parents seen them?
When I showed them the tattoos, like I sent them a picture, and I was like, "Look what I did." And my mom wrote back, "You're really a weird child." Like, they weren't like, "Thank you, this
oh, wow,
is so
touching."
Yeah. My family was just like, "Leave us alone."
Oh, I've got to tell you my Steve Martin story.
I can't
because
wait.
I wanted to. So I went to see
as
Meteor.
You're talking, I'm plugging in my vape. Yes, I'm addicted to juuling, guys. I'm not proud, but it's just what's happening.
So we were talking about Steve Martin.
Excited.
So we're talking about Steve Martin. So I went to see a year and a half ago, Meteor Showers on Broadway.
Yeah.
I went with the producer friend. And he said, I've been speaking to Steve. And Steve said, do you want to come by the apartment afterwards and talk about the show? And he said, do you want to go into Steve Martin's apartment, Upper West Side, after the show? And I was like, fuck yes, of course I do.
So
of course
cool.
I do.
Yeah, you're like, I found myself in another one of these situations,
yeah.
Guys.
And he was like, oh, okay, cool. And I was like, as if I wouldn't want to do that. What part of you thinks I would be like, not tonight, I'm kind of tired. Yes, of course, we saw the show. Then we're heading up there and we got in the elevator and I'm like, this is crazy. And the elevator door opens and it's like, hello, it's Steve Martin. I'm like, hey, he said, come through. And I was like, all right. So we go into his apartment, and my friend goes forward with Steve, and then I'm with his wife, and I meet his wife, and she's adorable and
she's
lovely.
She's great. She's so nice.
So nice. And I go, oh, my God, you've got two Giorgio Morandi paintings in your lobby. They're beautiful. She went, no, 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 there's a third just on just around the corner. And I was like, oh, my God. So I walked around the corner, went, that's even better than the other two.
They're no, like, wait, his art collection's unbelievable.
And I was like, And then so we went in the kitchen, there's art, and then we went in the living room, and there's an amazing art everywhere, and there's like a Francis Bacon, and there's a Sonia Delaunay, and there's just amazing works. And I'm sort of sat there, and he's like, so what do you think of the play? So we started talking about like the play, and I was down about the play, but all I want to talk about was the art collection. Yeah. I love the play, but I want to talk about the art collection. And then we started talking about the art collection, and then he said, oh, you must come through to my office. And there was like an Edward Hopper in the office.
Whoa.
And then we're sitting, and then he pulls out his banjo, and he sat there like playing his banjo, and we're all talking about art and his art collection. And then he was saying, you got to look at this artist, Norman Lewis and Alma Thomas, who are these African-American artists that have sort of been overlooked, but now he's been a massive champion of their work, and he had the work there. And then like in the last 2 years, I've seen their work everywhere, and like Kerry James Marshall has been really pushing Norman Lewis, and it's so exciting what he's doing. And it was just one of the moments where you're like, this is fucking crazy. And he says like George Kondo goes over there for dinner all the time. And
so cool.
I love when people who have money and influence decide to collect art. I think it's so interesting because those celebrities could do anything. They could collect Maseratis, they could collect vintage watches. Right. And same with rich people. Like, even though I said that the art world is like, it's unfair that it's all dependent on wealthy people, I also deeply appreciate that there are certain people who choose to spend their accumulated money by surrounding themselves with beautiful objects, because it's not just about that. It's actually them supporting the lives of creative people. Mm. And, you know, we don't have patronage anymore. The closest thing we have to it is art collectors. And it's just, you know, it's just a really...
And as long as they're sharing it, you know, because he was so happy and excited about my enthusiasm and to share it with me. And that's amazing. If people aren't really letting people into their homes living with it, I suppose it's different.
You
but my experience of art is that
share it.
I just want to talk about it. And when people come to my flat, I'm like, you know, let's talk about all this. It's amazing.
Something I've had to think about a lot is, you know, I don't like thinking about my parents dying, and I hope it never happens. But when you're the children of artists, prolific artists, you have to think about how you're going to handle their work.
Estates,
and we've had a lot of conversation. You know, I've had to pick an executor for my estate, and it's my producing partner, Liz, who's amazing, and I know if anything were to happen to me, would handle things beautifully. And you know, my mom would probably like you know sell all my effects to some random person and buy like a second house and a lot of shoes. I don't know what would happen. but I think about it because it's going to be my sibling and my job to really figure out how to support their legacy. And I often think about the fact that they have an amazing home in Connecticut where they both work, and that I'd love to turn it into like a sort of combination like museum, arts education center, artist residence, the same way that Robert Rauschenberg's Captiva home has been turned into an artist residency.
Did Jackson Pollock's place, Lee Krasner's, is that an artist residency or is that just kept as like a museum?
I think it's kept as a museum, but there are a bunch that are artist residencies. My podcast, The C Word, I host it with my friend Alyssa Bennett, who's a gallery director at Gladstone and an art historian, and she just did a residency at the Rauschenberg Institute. And I was just thinking, like, she's such an important writer, thinker, artist. And it makes me so happy that there are places that she can go. Uh-huh.
Yes, incredible.
You love the podcast. I love the C Word.
I love this. I really love it.
We have really a lot of fun, I have to say. She's such a genius, Alyssa. And then she just, like, she brings the genius and I bring the embattled celeb perspective, and we just go to town. We have fun.
How long have you been doing it?
So we've done 10 episodes. We've been doing it we started a year ago, did our first test episode. Right. We're about to start recording the second half of our first season because we do 10 and we really research them and go for it. But I want us to start expanding to do some more interviews. We're going to do an art world centered episode this year, which I'll save.
We should do a crossover, surely. Hello.
I think we should.
Yeah.
And I think you guys should come on our Jocelyn Wildenstein themed episode.
I love that.
Important art collector who had the most plastic surgery ever to make herself look like a cat.
Wow. Yes.
Bryda Wildenstein.
With a
love her. She's still alive. Is she?
Oh yeah.
Have you met her?
No, but I've seen her out and I would remember.
You've seen her out in the flesh.
Oh yeah.
And what's it like?
I mean, it
not
looks
it,
like
not referring to it's her, actually is it, almost what is the experience
beautiful,
like?
It looks like a sculpture. Looks right. like a sculpture's out. It's not gross to me. It just looks like a sculptor made like this intent. And it's also like, in a way, that is her art and her vision is like that she's going to literally, she wants to look like a cat.
But do you think she's aware of what she actually looks like in the world?
I think it's a really interesting thing, which is yes. And I think that she's not doing it for anyone but herself, which is right. a really crazy thing. And our misread of her is like, oh, she's this old woman who just wants to look young and beautiful. But it's like, if she wanted to look young and beautiful, she'd get a facelift and some lip injections like everyone else. She
yeah.
wanted to look like a like Bengal
that.
Cat.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. And it's artwork.
It's artwork on her face. And she's fucking smart. She knows what she's doing.
And Wildenstein was her husband who was a plastic surgeon who did all the operations, right?
I think that he was, and they've been big art collectors, and he was incredibly wealthy.
Wow.
Jocelyn Wildenstein, baby.
So you're doing an episode where is she going to be on?
I don't think so. I think
so
we're
why
just
do you, how
chat
do you think talk
her.
Art fits in with that?
We'll talk about the art world
we'll
and
talk
how
about
it
the
inspires
art world and
them.
See, and we can talk about
because
Orlan.
Because how much plastic surgery you've had, Russell.
and different...
to look like
I'm going
to
think about this one.
Yeah.
Well, we can also talk about artists who use their bodies. We can talk... because there's that famous artist who got all the plastic surgery as a part of her... project, but now I'm forgetting her name.
Is that Orlan?
Yes, Orlan.
Yeah, Orlan. Yeah,
Orlan,
that's what I was
course.
Saying. Yeah, Orlan, exactly. And there's that amazing man who did the huge performance at Tate recently, Frank or something. He's incredible too.
Who?
Performance artist. Yeah.
Yeah, performance artist. Yeah, and he like bleeds down the catwalk and stuff.
Speaking
like,
of plastic
really
surgery, being in England because everyone's getting lip fillers here because of Love Island,
right?
And they sell lip fillers for like $19.99 on every street corner. I keep being like. Is the world trying to send me a message that I need lip fillers?
I don't think I need
lip fillers? But I'm not going to do it.
I don't think you need it. I just this morning read your article for The Guardian about Love Island.
Oh,
and do you know the thing that I thought was so genius? The end when you're like, I just wish summer would last forever or something. Or, you know,
I
found it so sweet. It was like the end of a kind of, it was like an end of an episode of Happy Days or something. You know, when you're a kid and you watch those old American TV shows.
Yeah,
I was like,
yeah.
I love the
so
way
much
you wrote
fun.
That.
Thank you. I love Love Island. I think Love Island is art.
Well,
oh,
I haven't.
God,
I have
yeah.
to admit, I haven't seen it, so I can't really
well,
comment.
Well, get started. I saw 60 episodes.
60
this summer. I've been watching it since the day it started. Have watched 60 episodes. Only 3 have I not seen in real time. I was home every night. Only the reason I didn't go watch was because I had night shoots.
How do you do? You stream it from here?
Well, no,
or?
In Wales I have.
In Wales.
Oh, in
like
Wales.
TV.
Yes.
Oh, God. Okay.
And also,
I was in Wales when it started, and I was like, what else do I have
oh,
to
hang
do?
Hang on, so there's 60 nights it's on. In my head, I'm thinking
nights.
You've seen... Right.
Yeah, but also you must have learned about it previously through Daily Mail Online.
Well, I'd always see these people, and I'd be like, who the fuck is this? And then when I finally saw Love Island, I was like, yeah, these people are the biggest celebrities in the world to me now. Like, I have to tell you, Molly Mae Hague, social media influencer Molly Mae Hague, is a straight up bigger celebrity to me than like...
I know.
You know, literally a bigger celebrity to me
it's
than
so
like
weird. It's that
Margot
low rent fame, reality fame that I get more starstruck by. I went to an ITV party and there was all the people there who are like people I'm meant to be like networking with and talking to and being like impressed by. And then there was people from The Only Way Is Essex who were in the same room.
Oh yeah.
I couldn't cope.
You were with the Towies?
Yeah. The Towie gang and Arj and Lydia walked past and they were a couple at the time. And Chloe. And it was just like...
The GC. I love the GC. I'm going to go to Gemma Collins' store because it's a store for fabulous curvy women like me. And I want to meet Gemma Collins. I love her so much. I love Towie. Arj was not nice when he fat shamed GC because he was in no position to do it. But I understand that relationships are complicated. My feeling about UK... social media stars ever since I came to London for a show my mom was having when I was 12 and I spent the entire time in my hotel room watching S Club 7.
Oh, I loved S Club 7.
And I did not, because are you and I the same age? How old are you?
I'm going to be 30. I'm born 81, so you're 3 years younger.
Okay,
than me.
So it is so crazy. I was like, this is my life. Like I love S Club 7. Yeah. I can't even like go out to this like gorgeous party at like the Serpentine because I'm watching S Club 7. To Steal My Life Today.
I did an episode of Holby City when I was a kid with Jeremy Edwards, who at the time was dating Rachel from S Club 7 around Christmas time, and they'd just released their single, Never Had a Dream Come True. And I remember I was sitting there in the green room.
S Club 7 had released their single.
Yeah, their single, Never Had a Dream Come True.
I know
and
it.
And the video came up, Never Had a Dream Come True. Till the day that I found you. Anyway, that was on TV. And I was sat next to him between scenes in the green room, and the video of that song came up with his then girlfriend on it, and I remember just having a mini kind of meltdown in my head.
What did he say? Was he like, my girlfriend?
He was just super cool with it. He was like, oh, there she is, yeah. And we sort of watched it, and neither of us really commented on it, but in my head I was having this absolute, like, existential starstruck meltdown. Like, know her, and she's there, and I can't put this together in my head.
I had a really similar thing. My best friend at school, Andrew Chaplin, he used to work behind the scenes on TV channels, or like, what's it called? Channel 4 used to have that morning program.
T4.
And then he did the National Lottery, which was like when the lottery came to England, they had a music guest every week. So I used to go every week, and we met like Natalie Imbruglia, Kylie, and I was wearing this sheepskin coat, and my brother had just died, and I was really depressed. And Kylie came and sat next to me and was like so sweet to me, asking if I was all right. And I was just like, I love Kylie. And it was during her like Did It Again phase, when she wasn't, you know, having the huge pop hits. It was kind of her indie Kylie phase.
Yeah, yeah.
So she didn't have like all the people around her. So she was just being very down to earth and very sweet. But the thing I got to do was hang out with the Spice Girls. Mm. And it was when they did Spice Up Your Life. Mm. And it was the most surreal thing, because I'd been obsessed with the Spice Girls through my teens. And then to actually see them all just sat next to you in the green room was the weirdest thing. And one of them
BBC.
Went for a cigarette or something. And I was like, they smoke? Like, they're real people? Like, it was mad.
I had that at BBC, and all of Take That was sat in the booth.
So good.
They're all just squashed in. When I was a kid, I was 11 doing a TV show there. And I couldn't cope. Nothing makes sense anymore.
It's so wild to me that you were a child actor, because I also feel like that has something to do... We'd have to spend a while psychoanalyzing that, but it's almost like for you, art collecting, becoming involved with the art world was also like a way to like be your own person and individuate yourself from this thing that you'd been doing your whole life, probably.
I guess so.
I've actually said to him that doing the podcast is a bit like, it reminds me of going to my master's university, where we would have like visiting practitioners, like artists, gallerists, whatever, come and talk to us.
Yeah.
And I said to him, you're actually basically doing your master's or your BA degree doing this podcast, but also by collecting. And
one
he's educated himself, and it's such a brilliant thing.
One of my best friends just left today. He came to visit me for 3 days because I wasn't feeling well when I wrapped my show, and it was so sweet. He just came and like picked me up, and he drove me to Dungeness to see Derek Jarman's house.
Wow. Love it. I just went recently too.
And I was feeling, it was amazing. Yeah. And I was feeling really not well. I have like, I have issues with my, like I have a form of rheumatoid arthritis. So some days it's really hard for me to move. So he just drove me. I lay down in the back of the car. I got out. We walked slowly around Dungeness, but just seeing the place where Derek Jarman spent the end of his life gave me this gust. But he went to Yale graduate school, and now he's doing like a fellowship at the Rijk Institute in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. He's an incredible sculptor named Ian Page. And he was just so inspiring because we went to college together. And like for us, it was like a reminder of where we started, which is just like, you know, together thinking about these visionary people and thinking mm-hmm. like, how are we going to form our lives and become artists? And it was really special to go and in different but very connected ways, we've each become artists and we get to spend our time together, and it's just, it's really great.
Is the house preserved?
It's totally preserved.
Wow.
I know my mom shows at the same gallery that represents Derek Jarman's estate, Amanda Wilkinson here.
Oh, yes.
And so I know that I think Derek Jarman's partner still lives there part of the time and keeps it preserved. And then they have a sign that says, it's polite to watch from the road. Because people come, I mean, there was three, it was the morning on a Tuesday, and four other people were there. I loved it. A few caretakers were taking someone in, like a woman who was like in a wheelchair and not totally conscious was there just like enjoying the estate, and an older couple. And Ian and I, we did trek a little closer to the house than we were supposed to. We did veer off the road a little bit because I wanted to. I wanted that selfie, guys. But it was really special.
I feel like when I was there, I went there about 4 or 5 months ago, actually on a date.
It's a good
maybe
date
longer
spot.
Than that, date 8 months ago.
I wish someone would take me on a date to Dungeness. That's
well,
hot.
He does props and sets on movies, and so he's a kind of very DIY kind of guy, like, and he had a white van, and he drove me in his white van all the way down to Dungeness for the day. And I think they were actually painting the house.
No way. Yeah, well, it looks, like, great. It looks fresh.
Yeah,
it looks
exactly.
Fresh.
Yeah.
There's a poem. I couldn't read the poem, but there's like these carved letters on the side of the house that, and the yard is full of German sculptures, and it's just beautiful. I'm in the process of actually building a house that my dad and his close friend David Burrs, who's an architect, I'm building a small house behind my parents' house on their compound in Connecticut.
Wow. Wow.
And my dad and David designed it. And they designed it. It's not big. It's a, by anyone. I mean, it doesn't look like some big celeb house. It's like a little dinky house. But they designed it to specific specifications so that it would fit. All I cared was that my Ellen Birkin Blitz could be hung.
The shoe.
Yeah. The huge shoe.
Finally get it
I
home.
Wanted to have a place for a watercolor. My dad... It's really beautiful. For my 33rd birthday, my father designed and had fabricated a rolling watercolor table for me that had places for all my brushes and my cup of sunk place for my cup of water. It's so beautiful. So he's going to build me this whole studio in the basement of my new house. And then it's going to have space for my Birkin Blit and lots of windows and places to put up art and be close enough to my parents so that we can kind of have our little compound. And I think that's my Derek Jarman dream coming true.
That sounds like heaven.
That sounds like total visit. Heaven.
Yes,
I'd
please.
I'd love to have you two. And then it's going to be ready in the spring when you're on Broadway.
Yes.
So guess what, guys? You can come stay at my house, interview my parents,
love
see
it.
The
Could
studio.
Could come after the matinee on Sunday, stay
and
over.
Stay over.
How long does it take to get to Connecticut from Manhattan?
2 hours.
Yeah,
driving
close,
or flying?
Or...
Driving,
yes.
It's 2 hours drive. It's nothing. We'll drive. My
it's
going
to be every weekend.
I mean, you can come anytime.
So
it's the
interviews.
Coziest. Also, my mom will want to like... She never cooked when I was a kid, but now that we're out of the house, she just is like... Basically, she wants to entertain handsome gay men, so you're in.
Love her. I actually
her
really
passion.
Would. We would love to interview both of them. They're so incredible.
So come. Yeah. That would be my dream
there,
is for you to come.
And also, having listened to your podcast, there were two things that I took away that I was really touched by to do with, I think it was when you were interviewing your dad, actually, because there's an episode of, is it, it's not the C word, is it? It's the Women of the Hour.
It's Women of the Hour
Women
where
of the
I
hour,
interview my dad.
Which was your own podcast prior to the C word.
Yeah, I interviewed my dad about doing mushrooms.
Exactly. And I loved that story, how like you opened the fridge one day and then you saw the mushrooms in there and the whole of your reality was like shattered.
Crumbled. I was like, my dad is a drug addict. And he was like, I take mushrooms once a year. And I was like, my dad, I like didn't understand the difference between someone who does psychedelics once a year and is like a straight up on the street injecting themselves, selling their body for crack addict. Now, I mean, living the life I've lived, I have zero judgments. But at 14, I was like, my life is ruined. And then in college, I was like, can I have some of your mushrooms? Like, it really turned around.
I thought the description of it where you're like running to the supermarket or something. It was so
weeping.
Cinematic that
I
was like,
you
can... I ran
to the supermarket weeping and found my dad like buying us pasta for dinner and was like, you liar. And he was like, what the fuck is going on? My poor father dealing with my mother, my sibling, me, like... His life has just been a series of humiliations, but he is bearing up well under the pressure and carrying on and making his art, and I'm very proud of them both.
We love
the other thing that they said to you, or one of them said to you, was that your work chooses you if you let it. And I thought that was such a great thing for people to take away, because we have a lot of artists and writers and different creative people listening to this show. And I thought that was such a great thing to say, because when we started doing the podcast, a few people said to us that what comes easy to you is often what you don't want to do, because it's easy. And why would you do that?
Yeah.
And we didn't realize how we enjoyed talking to people and broadcasting almost. And it wasn't something either of us had thought we were going to do. But actually, it is really important because it can help other people as well.
It can. And I also think the thing I would always say to young artists in any medium, whether they're actors or writers or photographers, is like, it's good to be disciplined, obviously. And if you have a job to do, work hard. But you also don't have to be so fucking tough on yourself. Like, I think a lot of young people think they have to torture themselves into making work or make themselves miserable. But it's like... You can actually get a lot of creativity out of just being kind to yourself. And also, we live in this culture that's obsessed with, like, you know, everybody, you know, being like the youngest model, the youngest actor, the youngest artist. It's okay to take your time. Like, I'm 33 and I've been in the public eye for 10 years making work. And I feel like I'm just starting to figure out who I am as an artist. And I love, like, my mom says all the time, that she didn't, I mean, my mom started showing when she was 27, but like it's in the last few years that she feels like she's really settled into appreciating the career she has. My dad's career didn't really even start till he was in his 40s. Like it doesn't have to be, I know Marilyn Minter's always like, I became a star at 66. Like, it's like,
yeah,
people keep going and just keep doing what you love. And like, it sounds so cliche, but like, you know, obviously if you're not, if, like, if you're hiding in your house, this isn't the case, but it's like, if you're just doing what you do and sharing it with people in a way that feels good, like the right people will find you and your career and life will form itself. You don't have to like hustle and network and push and hurt yourself. Just do what gives you joy.
I think in some ways, if you like your own work, that in itself is a success.
Well, haven't you ever had the experience of having something be a success, but you yourself don't believe in it? And that's as painful. Like, we think we want success at, we think we want success at any cost, but no, the only time criticisms really hurt me is if I thought they were picking up on something real, which is that I wasn't 100% behind.
Oh, wow.
Like, if I let something out too early or I did something against my best interest, and now I really sit with myself and meditate on, like, do I actually want to do this? What does this mean to me?
And that's definitely something that comes with age, I think, that confidence and strength in your own decision-making and also trusting your own mind, I guess. I remember when I was like 19 and I turned 20, I thought I was a failure because I hadn't become a big pop star yet. And I had I was working with, you know, big producers and making a record and all this stuff. And I literally thought it was over for me because at the age of 20, I was over. I mean, that's just mad.
One of the people that I worked with literally was like one of my best friends who I made things with when I was young. When we turned 25, we are like, we've known each other since we were born. She's coming to visit me tomorrow, my friend Isabel, and she's in, her father is Peter Halley, that artist.
Oh wow, we love Peter Halley.
Yeah, he's amazing. So Isabel Halley, his daughter, is my best friend. And we grew up together.
But he's had the big moment happen the last like 4 years or something, and he's always working. And he sort of was in fashion and really out, and now like he's everywhere.
I love his public art as well, the giant ones in like airports in Fort Worth.
Yeah, and he started Index Magazine, which was an amazing 90s magazine.
Awesome,
but so Isabel's a ceramicist. She's an incredibly gifted ceramicist and my childhood best friend and continuing hero. Isabel Halley.
Okay.
So her Instagram is at Isabel Halley Ceramics. And we used to do this web show called Delusional Downtown Divas that was about these, I'm going to put it back online. It was about these three girls who were obsessed with entering the New York art world at any cost. So we did these episodes. We did them with, I mean, our guests were amazing. It was everyone from like Isaac Mizrahi to Nate Lohman to my mom, to Joan Jonas, we did an episode with, and they were narrative. She's incredible. They were Rob Wynn. They were narrative episodes, but we did them with real artists who kind of acted in them. And these girls were obsessed with becoming these like overnight successes. And so we made the show and we ended up doing two seasons of it. One we was funded by the Guggenheim and was one of the first things we did. And when we turned 25, Isabel called me and she was like, this is terrible. I was like, what do you mean? She was like, we could never be precocious again. But you know what? Being precocious is fucking overrated and being cozy in your nightgown is underrated.
Mm-hmm. That's hilarious. Something else I've really loved is that you often highlight other artists or other creative people. And I feel like you've done a lot to sort of champion others, which is actually a really special thing. And I think true artists will do that. They will always, you know, champion others. And this week you highlighted an artist that I'd never heard of called Lucy Jones. And I love Lucy Jones' work.
Isn't she incredible?
And thank you for telling me about her because I didn't know about her work.
She's amazing. And she's dealing with being differently abled.
Yes.
And she expresses
palsy.
She has cerebral palsy and she expresses it through her paintings, which are stunning.
But they're incredible works. And I can't believe.
Incredible.
Like, there's actually an exhibition in England. And I'm a gallerist in England.
Where is it?
Is it Flowers Gallery? No, who does she show with? No.
Yes.
Is it Flowers?
I thought, it's amazing. Yeah. Her work's amazing.
Yeah. So I'm just, that's just one tiny example though.
That's from Kingston Road, isn't it? Flowers East? Is it that gallery there?
Yeah, but
this is a great place city to see art. Have you guys gone to see the Lee Krasner at the Barbican yet?
Not yet. That's on the list.
Okay, I'm going to go tomorrow if anyone wants to come with me.
I'm working tomorrow.
Are you
got the weekend possible?
You're working.
I'm back in Margate tomorrow, yeah.
Well, I'm not going to be here on the weekend, but I'll be back next week. But I love Lee Krasner because I just read that book, Ninth Street Women.
I've got that on reading.
I haven't seen it yet either.
It's so good. And for a minute, all I would do was paint paintings of Elaine de Kooning, Lee Krasner, and Grace Hardigan painting their paintings. And finally, my dad was like, you have to stop only painting paintings of these women painting their paintings. But I made a painting of Elaine de Kooning and her husband for my friend Batsheva, who's an amazing fashion designer. And yeah, I love creative people. I love creative women. It gets me just crazy with joy.
Well, her story, I mean, is incredible as well, isn't it?
Beyond words.
Yeah.
So every guest we have on Talk Art has to answer two questions.
I know. I've been planning my answers.
I still can't believe you've been listening to our show, though. I love this.
I've been planning my answers.
Yeah. So if you could do an art heist and go to a museum or anywhere or someone's house and take an artwork home with you, what would it be?
Okay. I would go to the Met under the cover of night. I would enlist the help of security guards. I would befriend them so that they, because they're the people who know all the codes, and I'd have to get a docent too, and some art handlers. And I would take in the Renaissance painting hall the painting of Joan of Arc, where she's standing in her yard hearing the voice of God as she looks up at a tree. And right now I'm forgetting the name of the painter, which I know isn't helpful, but it's a really famous painting. It's been in the Met forever. And it's Joan of Arc as a teenager when she first hears the voice of God. And it really, to me, I've been obsessed with it since I was a kid. But as I get older, this painting, which is obviously by a man, which is not usually part of my collecting rules, that's okay, has come to me to be about like the moment of inspiration and also the moment of like hearing the call and listening to it. So I would want it in my house. And then I'd have to replace it on the wall with something. So I'd just put up one of my mom's pictures and go. So that she could claim her rightful place.
I love that you chose Joan of Arc. What so is it the, this one here? Is it Jules Bastien Lepage?
It's Jules Bastien Lepage's Joan of Arc. It's an unbelievable painting.
And what is this yard
from
like?
1879. Oil on canvas.
Is this yard like the one you've got in Wales that she's standing
in?
It
kind of is. Like, it's a pretty Welsh yard. And she's just like looking so dreamy and pretty. But you can tell she's about to go fucking shave her head and like fight the Crusades as a man.
Wow. I know that you also love music. And I love the fact you have Liz Phair, by the way, making your...
We were singing HWC.
We were singing it. We were
going to
sing it to you.
She's my favorite. Are you going to sing it to me now?
HWC.
It's my favorite. She's my favorite. She's so amazing. She's a book coming out. I'm going to get to read it early.
But do you remember that lyric that Garbage did? That was like, I'm like Joan of Arc. Or something. I used to love Garbage was so good.
Well, you know that Joan of Arc quote that like every cheesy college girl has up on their board, but it's true.
What?
Joan of Arc once said, I'm not afraid. I was born to do this.
Wow. It's very Game of Thrones, isn't it?
Very Game. I mean, the whole Joan of Arc thing's very Game of Thrones.
I feel like Joan of Arc's inspired Madonna's new album as well. I think there's a track on
she
it.
She has.
Isn't there a track on it that's about Joan of Arc?
I love Madonna's new album too.
Me
it's
too.
So
it's
good.
It's the best she's done in ages, and
I
it's
love
so
that
good.
Song, Crave.
I like that she's
I actually quite like the Eurovision performance, which everyone hated in some ways, because
everyone
hated it. I really liked it.
Everyone wants to be mean. Madonna's a hot bitch. We know it.
Everyone wants to bring down women as well. It's not cool.
Yeah, and everyone wants to bring down Madonna because she's always pushed back and she's never just settled into the role people wanted for her. And they want her to just retreat into being a heritage act and tour like a virgin and like dance around. And she's not going to fucking do it because she's Madonna. Bitch, I'm Madonna.
And also her new record is so great. I mean, it's one of the greatest things she's done. Yeah. So respect to Madonna.
Respect. So the other question we ask all of our contestants, going to say.
Oh, you want a game show?
What's your favorite color?
My favorite color, it has never changed. It's been my favorite color since the day I was born. I believe it'll be my favorite color till the day I die. Ladies and gentlemen, it is pink.
Pink? Yes!
Any shade of pink or any pink?
It varies. I like a neon pink. Mm. All my homes are always painted like a soft baby pink, a color called Ballet Slipper. By Benjamin Moore. It's like a beautiful, soft pink. I also like a kind of salmon pink. Pink is my dad's favorite color too. Like, because he says it just has the most range and it's always surprising you in nature. Like a creamy salmon pink. I love like a dark, like kind of raspberry. I love like...
Or a dusky pink.
I love like a dusky pink. I love like the color of a human cornea. I love pink. I have a hairless cat named Lou who is... the most perfect baby pink cat. And also, my friend Ian reminded me the other day that in college I was stoned and I turned to him and I said, I wish I could sleep in a strawberry. But I do wish I could sleep in a strawberry. My whole life is aimed at the goal of sleeping in a strawberry.
That needs to become a photo shoot with somebody.
Someone's got to let me do it.
That is too good.
I love pink. And my new house is going to be pink.
Strawberry.
So you guys will come to my
pink
house.
You need to build a strawberry and then you could actually sleep in the strawberry.
Is it going
to
be like Connecticut shuttering, like tongue and groove sort?
Yes, only like a little modern and pink.
Heaven.
Love that.
Heaven.
So get in my home.
Lena Dunham. I said your name right.
I loved it. Russell. Rob. this podcast is great, and it's an honor. It's been an honor. Thank you for coming to my nightgown space.
Well, Lena D, you have been a joy.
Thank you.
By the way, that's another thing I loved was you and Emma Stone talking about nicknames and how men, often straight men on sets, will often be like, hey, darling. And you're like, don't call me that.
The guy that I'm working with right now actually exclusively calls me Lena Dunham. He'll always be like, hello, Lena Dunham, or Lena Dunham as I live and breathe. And I actually find it, there's a lot of respect to being called by your full, solid name.
Yeah.
Like if an I had a guy I worked with who was calling me M'lady, and I was like, oh, you gonna die.
This is in the UK. Or?
Yes. Yeah. It was so horrible. And I knew he thought he was being nice, but it was like, when I'm setting up a shot, I don't want to be called M'lady.
I actually realized that I called you Lena D.
I love Lena D. No, it's my favorite nickname.
No, but then I found out that you actually liked it. And I was like, I was calling you Lena D. I'd
it's
go
my
like,
passion.
Have you seen
in
Lena
high
D's
school,
new
my
episode?
Stand-up comedy name was, I would do stand-up comedy as Lena D. And I had a column in the school newspaper called Zoology with Lena D about animals.
Preferably pink animals.
Pink animals exclusively.
Well, thank you so much for coming
on
Talk Art.
Yeah, my God, amazing.
For everyone listening, we are going to post images of all the artworks we have.
There's a lot.
There's a lot to
We've talked
get
a lot
through.
About art, and I can send you some of the images of the ones I
yes,
own
please.
If you want to have some.
Yes,
do you know
yes,
what
yes,
I like,
yes,
though?
Yes.
Is I feel like you are someone that talks a lot about yourself, about your life, and you've shared a lot in the public, I guess.
Yeah.
But I like the fact that there isn't that much known about what you're into art-wise, and I'm glad that
no,
you're
this
now...
is an when I heard that you wanted me on the podcast, I knew it was an amazing opportunity to talk about something I really love, so thank you both.
Well, respect to that. We will be back very soon.
Yes,
thanks for listening.
Love. Thanks a lot.
Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.